Thank you, Joshua. It's so good to have you with us this morning. So I first heard about the Social Action Covenant Group that Kathy talked about when Mary Matheny sent out an email saying, with the subject line, "What to do next?" And I love that subject line because it wasn't really a question, it was simply an invitation to reflection. She sent out the email about a week after the Women's March. And because a number of people had been talking after that march, thinking about what to do next, that is, how to build on the momentum coming out of the march. Because it was clear that the march had tapped into a lot of energy, in particular, a lot of concern about how the current political climate poses a threat to women and to some other groups. The question of what to do next was a question of how to take that energy, how to take that concern, and to channel it into concrete action. And to me, the idea of a social action covenant group is a logical next step. Now, at first, that may not seem to be the case. In fact, it almost sounds like a paradox, because when you talk about a social action covenant group, you have on the one hand social action, which suggests, you know, action, and then you have a covenant group which suggests reflection, and those sound like competing priorities. But I don't think that's the case, and my thinking here has been influenced by Paulo Freire. Freire was a Brazilian educator and philosopher, and he was someone who worked with groups that were marginalized, oppressed, to help them improve their conditions. And he famously said that reflection without action is mere verbalism. That is, it's just talk, which is fair enough. But he also said that action without reflection is mere activism. That is, it's just action for action's sake. It's that knee-jerk reaction that Kathy referred to. According to Freire, reflection and action are part of a continuous process. First, we gather and we reflect on what we should do. Then we act on that. And then we gather again and we reflect on our action. So we reflect, we act, and then we reflect again, and that cycle begins again. This is what Freire called praxis. It's that interaction between action and reflection. And that is the thinking behind the Social Action Covenant Group, to provide a time and a place to practice praxis. But actually, I think this concept of praxis is critical to all the work that we do here as a faith community, especially in the current political environment. Reverend Anya has invited us to reflect on the difference between action that is partisan and action that is political. And it's a very subtle but important distinction. So here's how I think of it. And these are just my words. I'm not quoting Reverend Anya. But here's how I think about it. We are acting partisan when we are acting on behalf of a party or an individual, whether that's a politician or a candidate. So that's partisan. We are acting political when our primary interest is to support a value or principle, to see that value upheld or to see that value protected. That's political. Now, of course, as it happens, often a value or principle will be aligned with one party or candidate more than others. That's just the nature of the system. But when we're acting and talking politically, our primary interest is not party, it's not a politician, it is the value. So does that make sense? You can decide for yourself, but this is what we need to reflect on. We need to stop and think about how our actions reflect on our values as a faith community. And we need it now more than ever, because the partisan divide runs so deep, and emotions are running so strong. It's not easy to avoid lining ourselves up with one party or one candidate versus another, especially because there's a sense that stakes are so high that how could we do otherwise? And I know that this is something that ministers and faith communities are really struggling with. I'm part of a minister's Facebook group where they just talk ideas, you know, raise questions, et cetera. And this is a topic that keeps coming up, and I hear it from my friends who are ministers. How do you be political without being partisan? But reflection, though, is more than just a matter of keeping ourselves in line. It can also be essential to helping us understand what is the work that needs to be done. Freire talked about reflection in a very particular way. He said that reflection is a process of developing a critical awareness of one's social reality. It's developing a critical awareness of one's social reality. That is, it's about helping us become aware of the way that our society works. In particular, about the way in which society gives privileges to some and marginalizes others. As Freire saw it, we're all raised to believe in certain social myths. That's what he called them. Social myths, myths aimed at sustaining a status quo. For example, these days we often hear about how immigrants are more prone to crime and violence. That is a social myth. We hear that Islam is not a religion, but a political ideology. We also hear that this is a Christian nation. That is a social myth. And then, one of my favorites, that all women deserve less pay because their first priority should be to be at home. And, you know, when I wrote this earlier this week, I almost didn't leave it in because it's like way too obvious. But then, a Utah lawmaker, a state legislator, actually wrote a letter to a newspaper, wrote a letter to the editor at a local paper, arguing that equality in pay is actually bad for society. And it goes something like this, because if you have an equality in pay, the businesses will have to accommodate by actually lowering the pay of men to raise the pay of women, which will make it harder for men to make enough money to support their families, which will result in more women entering the workplace, which is a really bad thing because they really should be at home. Social myth, do you see it? That is a social myth. As long as we don't see those myths for what they are, the status quo is safe. And the biggest threat to the status quo is reflection in education. Because once we recognize how these myths operate and whose interests they protect, then change is possible. As an example, there's the magical Negro syndrome. Has anyone heard of this? I know it's an awful phrase. I hope someone's heard of it and realized it's an awful phrase, and for a good reason. So this is a idea that comes out of film criticism, but you also hear it in literary criticism, but especially in film criticism. Because over the last couple decades, critics noticed that there was kind of a trend in how African Americans were being portrayed in film. Often they were being portrayed in a positive light. That's good. But that was primarily when they were coming to the aid of white characters. In essence, the worth of these characters was defined by their relationship with white characters, with people of privilege. So while they might be portrayed as wise and benevolent, they were also portrayed as subservient. And there's the status quo. I first read about this trend back in 2000 when a movie called The Legend of Beggar Vance came out, and it fit this concept to a T. It was about a white golfer who, very much a person of privilege, but he was struggling with life. Anyway, so he had entered into this golf tournament, and right before the tournament, this person shows up and says, "Oh, I'm going to be your caddy." And he not only becomes the man's caddy, but becomes his life coach, and he helps him get his life back on track. That's the magical Negro. Once you get it, once you learn to see it, it makes you watch movies differently, and it makes you think about our culture differently. And this can be quite dispiriting, especially when we find ourselves falling into that trap. As an example, several weeks ago, I was quite happy to hear that President Trump gave a shout-out to Frederick Douglass. It was a little strangely worded, but it was a shout-out nonetheless. So Frederick Douglass, of course, was a famous abolitionist writer and orator and a former slave. And in his time, he was in the 19th century, he was incredibly famous because he's someone who really said, this is what slavery is about, and really tried to expose it. So he's like Sojourner Truth and others who really, you know, shined a light and said, this is evil. I know about Douglass primarily because I'm a Lincoln buff. And whenever you read a book about Lincoln, especially the development of his thinking, you hear about Frederick Douglass. And so I actually sat down to write a Facebook post about how Frederick Douglass was essential to the thinking of Abraham Lincoln, in particular because he had a habit of goading Lincoln, trying to get him to take a stronger stand against slavery, to be more aggressive. So I wrote that post. And, you know, I hit post, and then I sat there. And then it suddenly occurred to me, I just turned Frederick Douglass into a magical Negro. That is, I defined his worth strictly in terms of his relationship with Abraham Lincoln. And so I deleted my posts. It's dispiriting, but this is how critical awareness is supposed to work. We can't pretend that we haven't bought into these social myths. There's no way around it. They're in the air. They're what we're kind of raised to believe. But once we become aware of those myths, once we learn to see them, we can loosen their hold on us. And this is the kind of thinking that is behind the social covenant group. Because once we can see through social myths, we can see the work that needs to be done. That's what praxis is all about, seeing reality for what it is, and then being able to address it. So when you come back, when you think about the Women's March, again, it was a major event. There's no doubt about it. You know, I think one of the most important roles that it played was it showed everyone that you're not alone in being concerned about shifting attitudes towards women and other marginalized groups. That was a beautiful thing, but what to do next? To turn this great energy into effective action, we need to get a better understanding of our current context and how to go about changing it. We need to pause and reflect. We need praxis. But now, don't get me wrong, clearly, there are pressing problems that need to be addressed now, and sometimes we just need to respond. We just need to act. But the fact is, there's always something to be done. There's no end to it. If we really want to make a difference, we need to make some choices. Specifically, where do we want to put our energies? And this is a question that we all face as individuals and as a faith community, because there's two dangers here. The first danger is that we just spread ourselves so thin, we just kind of react, that we just burn ourselves out and we cease to be effective. The other danger is that when we realize how much there is to be done, we just sort of give up. You know, that the problems are too many, too big, we can't possibly make a difference, why should we even try? Those are the two dangers. We have to make choices. That's where reflection comes in. We have to decide what work to do. We have to decide where should we put our time and energy. Questions we might ask are, how do we get to the root of the problem and not just treat the symptoms? What are the particular passions and gifts that we bring to this work? And how are those passions and gifts best deployed? And I think about that in particular in the context of this community. We are a small community. We can be very effective. We've shown that. But we're effective when we choose where to put our time and energy. We need to pause and reflect. That is why reflection is essential to action. That is the function of praxis. But there's a deeper issue here. As I just said, there's no end to the work that might be done. Even if we manage to focus our energies, sooner or later, we might find ourselves getting burned out. And this is something I hear from people who do justice work. I was the acting minister for social justice at the Fairfax congregation, and so I worked a lot with people doing justice work, and I would hear them say it again and again, that it's just so, because there's so much to be done, it's easy to just get lost in the details and to lose sight of what they were doing. And when that happens, you burn out. So I just listed some practical questions that might help us decide what to do. But we also need to ask some more fundamental questions. That is, why are we doing this work? How does this work reflect our deepest values? How does this work sustain us, both as a community and as individuals? These are fundamental questions, and these are essential to the work we do. If we don't remind ourselves of why we're doing this work, if we're not aware of why we're doing this work, we're going to burn out. We're not going to be effective. Howard Thurman said, "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is people who are alive." This is why reflection is essential, because it's a way we ask what makes us come alive. Remembering why we do this work can go a long way towards renewing our energy. Think about last summer when there was that horrific shooting at the Orlando nightclub. Immediately after the shooting, Reverend Anya organized an interfaith candlelight vigil. After sunset, we went with candles and we stood at the intersections of Church Road and Davis Road. It was a beautiful event. We stood there in silence, but with signs. It was a beautiful event. But before we held that public vigil, we gathered here in the sanctuary, and together with people representing faith communities from around Loudoun County, we reflected on the importance of standing up to bigotry, standing up to intolerance. We reflected on how standing up to bigotry speaks to the heart of our different faith traditions. For me and for others, that time of reflection was essential. Because when we started gathering here that evening, I was here right at the beginning, as people were coming in ones and twos or small groups, the mood was incredibly somber. It was just an incredibly somber place. But as the service progressed, you could feel that energy shift. Through prayer and song and silence, we found it. We found the resolve we need. We found the strength we need to go out and stand against the darkness. Let this be our model. We have a lot of hard work to do in the coming months, in the coming years. The energy that we feel now, that sense of momentum, it's amazing, but it will not last. As time goes on, we will grow tired, and we will get discouraged. That just comes with the territory. But as long as we work together as a community, as long as our work includes both reflection and action, we will find a way forward. Together, we can seek, we can love, and we can serve boldly. May it be so.